Well, hello, everybody. Today, I'd like to welcome Drs. Sarah Handley-Cousins, Jonathan S. Jones, and Diane Miller Somerville to the show. Sarah is the Associate Director of the Center for Disability Studies and Assistant Professor of History at the University at Buffalo, and she is the author of Bodies in Blue, Disability in the Civil War North. Diane is a professor of history at Binghamton University, State University of New York, and the author of Rape and Race in the 19th Century South, and Aberration of Mind, Suicide and Suffering in the Civil War Era South. Jonathan is the inaugural Civil War Era postdoctoral scholar at the George and Ann Richards Civil War Era Center at Penn State, and is currently finishing up his first book, tentatively titled Opium Slavery, Veterans and Addiction in the American Civil War Era. Beginning in fall 2021, he'll be an assistant professor of history at the Virginia Military Institute. My guests today are all veterans of the show and all write about topics that in part form what some have called the dark turn in Civil War history. I've asked them back to discuss this so-called dark turn and how we might use it to rethink ideas about soldiering in the Civil War. This is a two-part episode, so stay tuned for part two later this week. Now, before we get rolling, let me implore you to use your better judgment and head over to theroguehistorian.com where you can subscribe to this show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to such things. And while you're there, please help a guy out and leave a rating and a comment. I love to hear from my listeners, and I'm constantly working to bring you the very best content possible. And it would be great if you followed me on Twitter at mkeithharris and Instagram at keithharrishistory. Okay, so let's welcome Sarah, Jonathan, and Diane to the show. All right, let's do it. Sarah, Diane, Jonathan, thanks for coming on the show. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you back. You are all veterans.
Yeah.
This is like a reunion, and we're all together. Isn't that nice? I wanted to have you guys on because something's been going on in the historiography, and I wanted you guys to contribute your voices to that. And what this is, for those who don't know the terminology, is a growing body of civil work scholarship that people are referring to as the dark turn. And I really want to edit in some ominous music there.
Yeah.
Because it's a dun, 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 dark turn. This dark turn, what is the dark turn, and why is it growing, so rapidly, in the discipline right now? Mm. This is open for anybody who wants.
Okay. So I'll go first. The dark turn, I think, is really a pivot to focus on the realism of the war, which includes a kind of a gritty underside. It focuses on the consequences of battles, not just the glorification of battles. And so that includes, therefore, a lot of topics that prior to now have been largely, not necessarily ignored, but only maybe rated a passing paragraph in a book or two. And we now have sustained studies of topics like disability and opioid addictions and suicide and trauma. Mm. That would be my definition.
Anybody else want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been labeled the quote unquote dark turn because it sort of tackles head on topics that are more difficult, right? You know, topics that are less sort of glorious and sunny, and you know, Diane used the word gritty, and I think that's a really good way of kind of characterizing it too, right? Like, you know, not just our three subjects, but also things like Megan Kate Nelson's book Ruined Nation, which looked at sort of the you know, destruction that comes along with the war, and Jim Downs's work on emancipation and illness and all of these other topics that are, you know, more difficult to sort of embrace. I think we've been really used to an interpretation of the Civil War that really placed an emphasis on the good and glorious aspects. And I think that there's nothing, you know, inherently terrible with that. That's part of the story as well. But I think the dark turn has been an attempt to sort of look into the more shadowy aspects of the war that have been sort of less focused on for a long time.
Right. It gives us a more comprehensive
right.
understanding of the Civil War.
Definitely.
And the Civil War literature is something that is so, I mean, just unbelievably vast. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's, I've been reading in earnest Civil War history for 40 years since I was a teenager. And it's only recently that this has really, that this has come up in any serious way, any serious takes on this stuff. And like you mentioned, you know, there's a paragraph here, a paragraph there, mm-hmm. But nothing really, really substantial. And I'm wondering why, with something, it seems so readily apparent to me that this would be a topic worthy of discussion when we're dealing with, I believe it was close to 3 million men who participated as in the armed services during the war, that these things that they experienced would ripple out into their personal lives and to the people, you know, to their families' lives, all these different things. Why has it taken so long for scholars to get around to talking about this stuff?
I think, you know, for certain topics that are sort of like put under this label of dark turn, like for example, suicide and drug addiction, I think part of the issue here was an issue with sources. Like a lot of, you know, for example, in my own work, a lot of the sources that I use to investigate like morphine addiction were not readily available to people before mass digitization. So that's just part of it. Like now it's possible to do these kinds of studies. But I think more importantly, you know, historians that are part of this so-called dark turn, which is, by the way, I want to point out, kind of like a pejorative for the movement itself. And some people embrace that and some people don't. Where was I going with this? I think a lot of dark turn scholars are responding to sort of the unwriting or what Carol Emberton has called the quote unwriting of the freedom narrative. Like scholars in, you know, historians of slavery and Jim Crow and Reconstruction, for example, are like showing that, you know, the Civil War wasn't necessarily this hard pivot point, right, between slavery and freedom. And, you know, there were lots of, like Jim Downs, for example, his book on the medical after effects of emancipation, you know, lots and lots of formerly enslaved people who are suddenly, you know, free have, you know, they suffer all sorts of really severe, harsh medical consequences of freedom. So I think the effects of that scholarly movement, at least for me, speaking for myself, have kind of rippled over into all other aspects of the war. Like if the war is seen as less cut and dry, like this great thing that like, you know, led to unambiguously, you know, good consequences, then what are some of the other more ambivalent consequences? Like, for example, like Diane said, like how did it affect people who lived through the war. And in a lot of cases, as it's becoming more and more apparent, it affected them negatively, right? It affected a lot of veterans badly.
Absolutely. I also think that there was a historiographical shift from those, the main authors of historical scholarship about the Civil War, largely political historians, military historians. Mm-hmm. And so they focused on the big policies, the big generals, the battles, and, you know, Lincoln. And eventually the profession has given way to more social history. And the questions that people are asking, like myself, who I consider myself a social historian, I really want to tackle what happens to ordinary men and women in all history, but in this context, Civil War. So I think we've seen the military and political historians lose some ground to the social historians, and that's part of the reason that we're now looking at these questions just now.
Diane, you brought up a really interesting point, and one that I definitely wanted to ask all of you. Together, I do a series in my advanced course on the Civil War Reconstruction on common soldiers, and we just did a class on some of the historiography, and of course we looked at the usual suspects: Bell Wiley and Reed Mitchell and James McPherson and Dudley Cornish and those who have written about the so-called common soldiers, if there even is such a thing as a common experience. I suppose that there are things that you can talk about there. But we also look at the writings of participants. We talk about John Billings, Hardtack and Coffee, and we talk about Carlton McCarthy and his what I call the excruciating minutiae of the Civil War, his book. And we also look at regimental histories. And one thing that struck me as I was preparing to speak with all of you today is that none of them really talk about any of the things that you guys discuss. And maybe they may mention something in passing from time to time, but you know, with your contributions and with the contributions of folks like Jim Downs and Megan Kate Nelson, you know, is it time that we really need to step back and rethink our approach to the history of common Civil War soldiers?
If I can jump in, I think that this is a really important point because, I mean, as everyone at this point knows, I've written a lot about Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. And he writes extensively after the Civil War. He writes and writes and writes and writes and writes. And he's famous for that writing. And he doesn't talk about his own experience really in his own writing. And I think that we have to remember that a lot of these the soldier narratives that we've come to sort of everyone recognizes, right? Like you mentioned Hardtack and Coffee and some of these other ones that are really well known. I don't have any of my books here at home with me, but I can't think of the name of the other one that I used several times. But these we keep going back to the same soldier narratives. And we think that because these themes don't appear in those soldier narratives, that they must be so marginalized, right? They must be so unusual that we have to go seeking them out. We have to go searching through things. And that is sort of true. If we want to find, like for instance, if we want to find the history of disability, we're not going to find it in these public facing narratives all the time because it was something that was stigmatized, right? It was not something that soldiers were encouraged to write a great deal about in their public facing work. So Chamberlain is never going to write in The Passing of the Armies about his genital wound, right? He's not going to talk about that. But when you go to his other writing, right, his private writing, his letters, his you know, medical correspondence, that kind of thing, it's everywhere in that. So like Jonathan mentioned, looking to different kinds of sources that are available to us now, especially through digitization, we can find those histories that aren't going to be available to us in the sources that we've been typically going to, right? Mm-hmm. I think that that's an important thing to remember. And of course, also looking beyond the same people all the time, or even looking into aspects of those same people that we think we know, right?
Right. Now, that's a really good point. And the digital world, I mean, for me, that's been both a blessing and a curse because on one hand, I can find all kinds of things, you know, just looking at Google Books or Google Scholar or something, mm-hmm. and all these things are keyword searchable, which makes my life extraordinarily easy. When I was trying to gauge, when I was writing years ago, trying to gauge how veterans thought about their prisoner of war experience, for example, mm-hmm. looking in the regimental histories, they always have a chapter on it or a few paragraphs at least, and you just type it in. It's very easy to find. On the other hand, you get to that point where it's like, oh my God, that you are overwhelmed with an avalanche of resources and you have to like cut it off at some point. You know, when do you mm-hmm. stop looking at this? And I was, you know, coming up right when everything was getting digitized. So it's great. I mean, I have to admit that I love it, and my students really love it too, because we don't have to travel to these places anymore. It's all just it's all available for us.
I'm sorry, I just thought of something else that you just raised. That, you know, I think a lot of this too isn't just in looking for new stuff, right? It's also reading the stuff that we have with a different eye, mm-hmm. right? Asking different questions of the things that we have. So like, there are lots of the, you know, letters and diaries and things like that that people have read before that they just haven't looked squarely at some of this stuff. Like I'm thinking of one of the reader's reports that I got once on my book, urged me to go back and read, you know, you mentioned Belle Wiley. And so I did. And I was like, okay, you're right. Belle Wiley is talking about lots of these things, like sort of talking about what it's like to be sort of a body at war, right? Mm-hmm. But nobody sort of up until this point, I think, leaned into looking specifically at that, looking squarely at those issues, right? When soldiers were talking about their physical experiences, nobody sort of centered that as part of their study. So I'm thinking of Catherine Shively's book, Nature's Civil War, where she does exactly that, right? She looks right at sort of how soldiers are talking about their physical experiences of warfare. All of that was right there in the open, but we just kind of weren't centering that in our analysis.
Isn't that weird how we do that? I just found the same exact thing. And when I was reading, I was rereading Hard Tack and Coffee for an essay that I wrote for a book that's coming out in LSU Press next year. That Stephen Cushman and Gary Gallagher are editing. And I wrote about Hard Tack and Coffee, and nobody ever mentions the ideology that's in that book. And it's just shot through with ideology. There's tons of it in there. You just have to kind of like look, ask the different questions when you approach it. That's a wonderful point that you bring up. You know, if we reframe our questions, we often see things from a different perspective, and it sheds light on stuff that we hadn't looked for. And Sarah, you brought something else up, being stigmatized for these things. And I wanted to ask you about post-traumatic, or what we would now call in 21st century language, post-traumatic stress disorder. They wouldn't have called it that, of course, in the Civil War, but we call it that. And I was wondering, is it safe to say that communities in general would have stigmatized men for, you know, openly discussing that as an experience, as a wartime experience?
A good question. I mean, I think that in my experience, in the research that I've done, I don't think I've ever really found somebody who, you know, described being really open and you know, forthcoming with talking about sort of the psychological aspects of their war experience. At least in the sort of ways that we would think about it today, right? Like almost like a therapeutic sense, like we just need to talk through this, that sort of thing. Mm. Instead, what I found, and of course this is skewed because I looked at people who were institutionalized, but I saw lots of people who tried to hold it together until they couldn't cope and then had some kind of breakdown and had to be institutionalized, which leads me to believe that they weren't feeling, they didn't have the outlets to be able to kind of deal with that emotion until it got to a breaking point, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I think that there's been a little bit of new work in this in terms of like soldier, like fraternal organizations after the war and groups of like POW survivors who turned to each other to deal with those issues, right? Or I think Leslie Gordon talks about this a little bit in her book, right? About the mm-hmm. the Connecticut unit where the veterans of a particular unit would kind of turn in to each other, right? Because they were the only other ones that understood that experience. But certainly, you know, in my research, I found that, you know, this was not something that soldiers would have felt as comfortable talking about, or that we would see talked about openly, maybe even in the ways that we do today, right? Where it's at least it's an issue that people generally are aware of and take into consideration when soldiers are returning home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I don't think they didn't talk about it for the most part. And if they did, maybe they did in those fraternal situations. But the way I do think it manifests itself was in a lot of really dysfunctional ways. You know, if you go back to Eric Dean's book, Shook Over Hell, and he looked at the Indiana Veterans Home, and Jonathan, you've looked in Veterans Home's records, so you can speak to this too. You know, and in my book, I talk about the very, very high percentages of those veterans who were violent or extremely violent, that they turned their violence inwards and they became suicidal, or they turned it outwards and they became a threat to society. You have high rates of alcoholism to deal with. And then of course, high rates of addiction as well. So mm-hmm. I think that there was very little room for veterans to talk about their feelings, right? That's the anachronistic. But there are these breaking points, you know, either they become a danger to themselves and others and they're institutionalized, or, you know, in the asylum records that I looked at after the Civil War, they were manic or they were delusional, were wandering around and they couldn't be protected, or people couldn't be protected from them, that then precipitated some kind of dramatic action. So, and I think all of those dysfunctional manifestations of their experiences, of the trauma that they experienced, I think all of these were reasons that tell us that they couldn't find positive outlets for talking about them.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on to that. Absolutely, that is this very similar to what I found in terms of violence. So many of the men that I found who were institutionalized either, well, mostly in New York State, were there because they turned their violence against their families, and particularly against the women in their family, their mothers and their wives. And in the research that I'm just starting right now, I'm looking specifically at veterans and crime. And one of the things that comes up over and over again, just with a quick newspaper database search, are the huge numbers of veterans who killed family members, who killed their wives, who killed their mothers, who killed, in some cases, their children. So, you know, as you say, like without other outlets, they're not going to have cognitive behavioral therapy, right? Mm-hmm. They're not getting psychopharmaceuticals. And so violence is unfortunately one of the ways that I think that trauma manifests.
Jonathan, I was going to ask you, Jonathan, and this is probably, you're probably about to respond to the question I'm going to ask you. Is this something that you found with, and by the way, the last time we spoke, you were preparing to defend your dissertation, which of course has now passed. So congratulations on that, Dr. Jones.
Hey, it did successfully pass. So that was a huge relief.
Isn't that the greatest?
I was there. Field? It was an amazing experience. He was one of the most interesting and engaging dissertation defenses that I've ever taken part in.
Well, that's good. That's great.
Yeah, and hopefully I'm working on the book now too. So, you know, the project is like actively under revisions, and hopefully we'll have a book, you know, in the next couple, like in the foreseeable future. So stay tuned for that.
We'll definitely look for that. Did you find a similar, similar to what we were discussing before about outlets? In terms of opiate addiction, this is something that we generally associate with the 20th century, you know, or the 21st right. century, soldiers coming back with addictions. You know, I'm thinking of the 1970s and 1980s, that was a big topic of discussion from Vietnam veterans who had
been right.
overseas. Now that they have a similar kind of outlet or anything at all resembling, treatment, something they could openly talk about and discuss with opium addiction in the late 19th century.
Yeah, this was so addiction to opiates was, you know, drugs like morphine and opium and laudanum was so stigmatized that, you know, like the conversation that we've been having around, you know, being open with your feelings and, you know, for a lot of Civil War veterans, opiate addiction was similarly so stigmatized that it was something that they were really usually reticent to talk about, right? But if you look at medical, like exchanges between, middle-class Civil War veterans who could actually afford to seek out doctors for treatment for addiction, then you see it sort of brought out into the open. So there were, after the Civil War, lots and lots of veterans got addicted to these drugs. And some of it was for reasons that we might associate with like self-medication for anxiety or depression or like psychological trauma coming out of the Civil War. I found lots of cases where guys had, not necessarily been shot or not necessarily contracted some kind of debilitating disease, but rather had started self-medicating with morphine during the war right before battle. And then they got hooked on it. And then they continued to be addicted for years or even decades after the Civil War. And eventually this grew into like such a big medical phenomenon that observers, like government observers, people's wives, people's family doctors, got really alarmed. And so eventually there was a push to start actually treating, like medically treating veteran opium and morphine addicts. So for example, in the 1890s, the federal government itself actually decided to open a medical treatment center in a soldier's home in Kansas for opiate addicted Union veterans. Right. And so the point of all of this that I'm trying to say is that for decades and decades, these kinds of issues were so stigmatized that, you know, very few people talked about them openly. And then there were these crises points, right? But eventually, in some cases, after the crisis point, you see state institutions, whether it's like the National Home for Disabled Volunteer Soldiers or asylums or police force, you know, they step in and they have to deal with the messy aftermath of like Civil War trauma that's been sort of covered up and you know, internalized. So there was a blow up in the end, and then, you know, the aftermath was messy in a lot of cases.
I think stigma is such an important part of the dark turn. You know, stigma affects even the questions that we ask about the past that we study, right? I mean, I think about this a lot, and I don't know if I have like a great answer for it, but, you know, the Civil War creates literally hundreds of thousands of disabled people on a variety of levels, black and white, and freed people and soldiers. I mean, the body is a huge part of this, right? It's a huge part of the story of the war. And yet, it's sort of when we start to look at it squarely, as Jonathan mentioned, like the dark turn is sort of a pejorative term because a lot of people sort of see it as marginal. And I think that the only way that we can see something like disability or, you know, addiction, which, or suicide as the three of us have sort of all studied as marginal experiences is if you think that those are marginal experiences today, right? If you think that those are things that are not really worthy of, serious kind of scholarly study today. I don't know. This is just something that I think about is how our kind of the way that we think about these issues today has a lot to do with how we think about kind of looking for them in the past.
And that's really an excellent point. And it brings me to my question. I wanted to ask Diane specifically, and you've written about suicide extensively. And when I think about suicide in the Civil War era itself, I'm often reminded of the, you know, of the famous examples, Edmund Ruffin, who took his life at the end of the war because, you know, he was now a man without a country, so to speak. But we often hear also that Abraham Lincoln contemplated suicide early in his life, early in his political career. We hear that William T. Sherman was overwhelmed by the responsibilities of command early in the war and considered it, and the newspapers, you know, cut him down for insanity and these kinds of things. And we hear these very exceptional stories. But then that's really it. And I think Sarah made a great point to say is like if you really look at this, I mean, would you think of marginalizing these same sort of stories in today, which we don't? We talk about veteran suicide all the time, and the numbers are really staggering. You know, how many veterans take their own lives? And I was wondering if you know, the Civil War is a similar thing, if it's much more widespread than we have assumed in the past, and what your comments on that might be.
You know, it's as you know, we can't do any kind of a statistical study. I can't answer questions about what percentage of soldiers committed suicide or thought about suicide. So that's kind of off the table. I would say, and you know, this is very clear that suicide was not a common experience, but it did happen. And there is this criticism against those of us who study the dark turn that, yes, if I can articulate the position, there's worry that by writing about these people and their experiences, that we're somehow going to universalize that. Mm-hmm. That they take strong issue with the fact that these are not typical experiences. Well, I think one is that we, you know, we have no idea of measuring what a typical experience was, but it's very clear that every soldier, every civilian who sent somebody off to fight in the war was affected by the war. But what's different is the wide spectrum of responses and effects that the war had on civilians and military. So I think that the number of suicides isn't so important because mm-hmm. it was relatively small, but it's extreme, right? It's an extreme reaction. So if soldiers are killing themselves, that tells us that how many, there's a certain number of people out there who are thinking about it, maybe who tried it and didn't complete the suicide. So I think that we have to temper the inclination to look at few numbers and say, oh, well, it really didn't affect that many people, therefore it's not really, you know, something that we should be consumed with studying, or it shouldn't be something that's really, you know, it's interesting, but it's not that terribly important, it's not central. So I think that is a bit misleading, that criticism.
Okay. Yeah, I would also just add that for the longest time I spent a lot of my like research period sort of like trying to figure out these ways to quantify the opiate addiction rate, or the rate of PTSD among veterans, or the suicide rate, or whatever rate it is that you know any particular scholar is focusing on. But like Diane said, it's impossible, just because, you know, the records that you know we might keep today about things like that were not kept during the Civil War era in the same kind of like consistent ways that they are kept in modern America. But B, I think the actual, like, you know, percent of people that suffered from drug addiction or alcohol or whatever is not important. I think what is actually more important in determining like the impact of these kinds of things after the Civil War is how people in like how popular observers, the media, the government officials, you know, state officials actually responded to these things. And it's pretty clear, like if you take crime, for example, and Sarah can speak more to this than I can. But if you take like the post-war crime wave in 1865 or 1866, like there were massive panics among city officials all over the North, right, Sarah? That, you know, Civil War veterans would leave the Union Army, come home and be like these terrible, you know, criminals, right? And so people, the fact that that idea, whether or not that actually happened, the fact that there was the fear of it manifested in actual actions for people. So again, the point that I'm trying to make is that the rate of crime is not important. It's the belief that there was going to be crime that animated people to react to that's more important. And I think whether you're looking at, you know, suicide or drug addiction or crime or alcoholism, there were popular reactions in the media, you know, among state officials, even among the federal government, to all of these things. And that implies that these were issues that were big enough that we should take them seriously as well. Like they weren't just sort of fringe issues that nobody in the moment noticed and that we're just seeing in hindsight. Like these were real issues to people that lived in the Civil War era. And to me, that implies their significance.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really super interesting point. And it brings me really a nice segue into my next question about Victorian manhood and the virtues that are associated with Victorian manhood. And we can look at that gender angle here too, which I think is important. All of these things that are taking place, you know, suggest, at least in terms of a popular response that Jonathan brought up, that you know, are they signs of weakness? Have they you know, compromised manhood in significant ways that cause some sort of panic, you know, in society, where there, you know, are people whose bodies are damaged, whose minds are damaged, who have displayed weaknesses in terms of addiction and these sort of things? Is there a crisis, a post-war crisis, regarding these sort of things?
Mm. Exactly. I think that's the thing that weaves through all of our work, mm-hmm. is that we're all very cognizant of the importance of viewing our historical questions through the lens of gender, and specifically about how 19th century notions of manhood, of independence and strength, and bravery, that all of these are suddenly in question with somebody who's mentally ill or who's addicted or who has, you know, is a double amputee and needs help putting his pants on. And that's one of the ways that we try to, I think, assess or analyze the consequences of the Civil War through this cultural construct, right? Because you know, there's this criticism out there about PTSD, for example. You can't study it because it, you know, that's somehow presentist or it's anachronistic. But in fact, the historians that I know who study something like PTSD are very keen on understanding it in the context of culture in which they study it. And that's certainly what I did, which is I tried to understand mental illness and suicide within the cultural constructs of manhood in the 19th century South. And I know Jonathan and Sarah are also very sensitive to that as well. It is indeed a crisis in gender. We're just expanding on that and getting a better handle on it.
Yeah. I think that this is, it was absolutely central to my work. I wouldn't have been able to, answer any of the questions that I set out to answer without looking at how this intersected with masculinity, right? And as Jonathan was talking about, you know, these sort of larger concerns or the perceptions that there was, you know, crime taking place or things like that, there was also sort of this, you know, a similar sort of concern that what is going to happen to American men, right? Like, what is going to happen when all of a sudden these armies demobilize and the war is done and they come home and they can't refill the positions in society that they used to hold, right? They can no longer be the breadwinner. They can no longer be sort of the master of the household in the same way, because now they require the care that they are actually supposed to provide, right? Like, now their wife has to go out and get the job. And you see this in, I mean, I always come back to that one really powerful cartoon. It's a Winslow Homer print that is in Harper's Weekly, I think in 1865. Megan Kate Nelson analyzes it in Ruined Nation really well, where I think it's called The Empty Sleeve at Newport. Mm-hmm. And it's a man and woman driving a carriage, and the woman is leaning out front, right, holding on to the reins, and she's the one driving, and the man is sitting back, and he's got her the veil from her hat has kind of gone over his face. And I don't know as if I've ever seen something that so powerfully encapsulated this like moment for gender, right? And at the end of the Civil War and after. But I also think it's really, this plays into also sort of how we think about disability or how we have thought about disability up until sort of this moment in historiography. And that's because it was so imperative for men to continue to behave in the ways that were acceptable for Victorian men to behave, right? That they themselves deflected attention away from their disabilities. And when they did that, they made it more difficult for historians to find it in the narrative. Or they sort of created personalities or whatever that we could sort of buy into what disability historians now call the overcoming narrative, right? Where, well, yeah, they were disabled because they had this technicality, right? Which was that they had only one leg or something, but they weren't really disabled because then they were successful after the war, right? Then they had a job or they went into politics or whatever it was. And so we actually sort of, even though we know physically that they are disabled, we stop seeing these people as disabled actors, if that makes sense. And that has a lot to do with the work that those people did during their lives to deflect attention away from their disability in order to better adhere to the strictures of manhood in that time period.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, do you ever find instances of veterans, especially those who have entered politics, who use their physical disability, the obvious disability from the war, as sort of a badge of honor in some way, saying that I gave this to my nation, now vote for me kind of a thing?
Oh, that's really interesting. I don't know as if I have. I didn't look a lot at sort of the intersection of politics. Mm-hmm. I know that Jim Martin writes about this in America's Colonel, about Corporal James Tanner. Like, he wore his double amputation like a badge, right? Like, he was like very, very out in front in terms of the political possibilities of being a veteran and being a disabled veteran. I more ran into veterans who entered into politics and then had sort of like a a much more complicated relationship with their disabilities, right? Of course, Chamberlain, he enters into politics such as it was for 4 years. You know, people knew he was disabled in the sense that they knew he'd been shot, right? From everything that I've read about his political career, he doesn't draw attention to it. He doesn't make it part of his political persona, right? In fact, he's very invested in sort of deflecting attention away from it, like, mm-hmm. you know, pretend that this didn't happen. But there was one guy that I just thought that this was such a fascinating case. And I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but he had been shot, and it was a sort of a through and through sort of situation. And so he had the lasting effects of that, right? But that was the kind of injury that a lot of people were very skeptical of having lasting effects, because they thought, like, well, you're shot and then you're fine afterwards, which is not true. But he had applied for a pension, and it was a pretty good one. And then he had applied for an increase in his pension. And then during one of those sort of like blow-ups about the surplus and the rising pension rates, someone had reported on the fact that he, like, how large his pension payout was, and the fact that he had requested an increase. And they said, well, but he's going to work every day, and he walks around, and he's obviously not disabled, and look at all the money he's taken out of the treasury. And so he said, okay, I'll give it back. And he just gave back tons of this pension money that he was getting rightfully, right? He had earned that pension payout, but because of his political position, because of the way that he was able to move and act in public, people believed that he was successful and therefore not really disabled.
Right, and I think
so. It worked in kind of the opposite way.
It seems I recall recently listening to one of your episodes on the Dig podcast about something along the same lines, and I can't remember the name of the exact episode, but you were talking about how pensions for Civil War veterans were really for, you know, disabilities where you could not physically go back to work. And if you were capable of going back to work, well, then you didn't need the pension because you were
right.
Be sure and tune in again later this week to catch part two of this fascinating conversation about the changing landscape of Civil War scholarship. And subscribe to the show at theroguehistorian.com so you never miss an episode. Peace. So let me take a sec to tell you all about an exciting project I've got going on at Keith Harris History. I've transcribed and podcasted a series of letters written by Confederate prisoner of war Henry A. Allen. Allen was an officer in the 9th Virginia Infantry who was captured at Gettysburg at the Bloody Angle, the culmination of the Pickett-Pettigrew assault on July 3, 1863. He served in various prisoner of war camps for the duration of the war. During this time, he wrote often to his wife Sarah, back in Portsmouth, Virginia, discussing the day-to-day life in Union prisons and his many thoughts on the war, his marriage and children, and life as a prisoner. I am currently annotating these letters to fill in the missing information and provide links to useful resources concerning Allen in particular and the prisoner of war experience in general. This is an ongoing process where I'll be adding new information and revising my commentary as my research on the topic develops. So please go to keithharrishistory.com, click on the podcast tab, and have a listen to the Civil War letters of Henry A. Allen. From there, you can explore all kinds of resources and book suggestions that will help enrich your understanding of Union prisons and Confederate prisoners.